dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A prevailing view of the present economic crisis can be encapsulated as follows. Greedy bankers and CEOs and arrogant Wall Street whiz kids, in the absence of effective regulation, took rash actions that resulted in economic catastrophe that has harmed many innocent people, and that in order to prevent further economic harms, these bad actors must be bailed out, albeit resentfully, in order to prevent a systemic collapse. As bad as this picture is, the program this week will present testimony that it is far worse than that. Here's a clip to demonstrate. The speaker is Professor Michael Hudson, an economist who you've heard on this show in the past. He was being interviewed by Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert, also familiar voices as the hosts of Truth About Markets on Residence FM in London. They have a new TV show called The Oracle, heard on BBC World. The clip I'm going to play you was from their February 27th show. The context of the discussion was the news that the U.S. government is pressuring Swiss banks, long known for their secrecy, to divulge the names of American account holders who may be evading taxes.
Now it's time for our final story. While the U.S. Secretary of State is over in Asia begging for handouts, the Swiss Alps are alive with the sound of revenge! Revenge! That's right. Apparently, the biggest political party in Switzerland is demanding the retaliation against the United States for essentially destroying banking secrecy in their tiny mountain nation. Stacy, the Oracle wants to know, without tax cheats and money launderers, can the Swiss banking system survive?
It appears not, Max, from these headlines. Swiss bank shares tumble as UBS tax probe widens. This is, of course, referring to the IRS is investigating UBS for harboring 52,000 American tax cheats. Swiss party wants to punish U.S. for UBS probe.
Michael Hudson, I see you waving no.
Every kleptocrat, every tin pot dictator in the world wants to put its money in a crooked Swiss bank. And the Swiss banks are crooks. And finally, the U.S. Treasury is moving against them for this.
Michael, on March 4th, there's a hearing in the U.S. Senate called Tax Haven Banks and U.S. Compliance, Obtaining the Names of U.S. Clients with Swiss Bank Accounts. Why the attack on Switzerland and not on the Cayman Islands or the Caribbean nations or the U.K. tax havens or Luxembourg?
Because the U.S. itself wants to be the tax haven for the tax dodgers of the world. The U.S., I've seen State Department request that the U.S. make the dollar essentially the tax haven to support the dollar internationally, because criminals are the most liquid people in the whole world. Criminals don't like to tear down their money in the form of assets that can be grabbed, property. They like to have it liquid, and there's a rivalry between America, Britain, and Switzerland for who's going to be the most attractive economy to criminals in the world. And the U.S. says, we want to get the Swiss business. We want the criminals to come here, not there.
Well, Mike, I think you touched on something, because I have a chart here of recycling of money into U.S. treasuries, because if you look at the other tax havens around the world. The United Kingdom, which includes the Channel Islands and Jersey, the Caribbean, Luxembourg. You see, they pour a lot more of their secret money into U.S. treasuries. Perhaps if Switzerland did the same, they might not be being probed.
Well, many of these Caribbean branches are branches of American banks. In 1966, the State Department and the Defense Department went to Chase Manhattan, where I was working. They asked Chase to set up affiliates in the Cayman Islands, in the Caribbean, precisely to get the world's drug money and arms dealing money and crook money. They said, we need this money to support the balance of payments and to support our foreign military spending, which is responsible for the whole deficit. So the State Department went to the banks
Told
the banks to go out and get this criminal money.
Once again, that speaker was Dr. Michael Hudson. Not a guy with a tinfoil hat on a soapbox. Hudson is a research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a financial analyst who has consulted on Wall Street for various national governments and recently served as the economic advisor to Congressman Dennis Kucinich during his presidential bid. You heard what Hudson said. What then are we to make of the war on drugs? Obviously, the war on drugs is not being conducted for the purpose of ending the use of drugs, nor has it done so, which makes the fact that millions of mostly poor people of color are being incarcerated even more abominable due to the level of hypocrisy and corruption involved. Consider this, if you will. Cocaine, one of the drugs central to the so-called war on drugs, is a powder refined from a tropical plant. Sugar is also a powder refined from a tropical plant. Sugar costs about $1 a pound. Cocaine costs about 3,000 times more. If not for the illegality of cocaine, its price would be similar to the price of sugar. The war on drugs is a way to perpetuate a very profitable business by keeping it illegal, while pretending to be eradicating it. And it is no accident, it is not incompetence, that accounts for the fact that after decades of a war on drugs, so-called, there are just as many drugs as ever. Let us now extrapolate this understanding to the economic crisis. Familiar to longtime listeners of this show, Michelle Chesedowski is a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa and a founder of the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. He's worked as a consultant for many international organizations, including the United Nations Development Program, the African Development Bank, the International Labor Organization, and the World Health Organization. In late January, he gave a presentation on the global financial crisis. Here's Michelle Chesedowski.
We are, I think, at the juncture of the most serious crisis in modern history. This is not strictly a financial crisis. It's a much broader transformation. It is not strictly limited to economic collapse. When we planned this event back in the month of November, we had not anticipated the events in Gaza and the devastation which has resulted from the Israeli-sponsored invasion. I think it should be understood that the war in the Middle East and the financial crisis are intimately related. Why? Because fundamentally, we're dealing with the same political and economic actors. The war in the Middle East is a war of economic conquest. It's a war which purports to gain control over 60% of the global reserves of oil and natural gas. It's worth noting that Gaza is also a major energy economy, although it's not widely known, but the coast of Gaza has significant reserves of natural gas. And one of the objectives of this invasion is to gain control over the gas reserves, which, from a legal standpoint, belong to the Palestinians, and upheld, incidentally, by the Israeli Supreme Court. So that invasion has also a geopolitical intent to it, and it's part of a broader conflict. I mention this because I think that despite the fact that we're focusing today on financial issues, we should understand what we're dealing with in a broader sense. War and globalization are intimately related. The military roadmap is to support an economic agenda. It's worth noting now, and that's not something which is trivial, is that some of the financial actors are in fact also involved in Israeli politics, such as Stanley Fischer, former deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund, has become governor of the Bank of Israel. What I'm suggesting here is that there are a number of major economic actors, they're corporate actors. Broadly speaking, we're dealing with Wall Street and a financial establishment which in recent years has developed a whole gamut of new financial instruments, what we normally refer to as derivative trade. We have the oil conglomerates. We invariably describe these oil conglomerates as the Anglo-American oil giants. They are, in effect, Anglo-American because British Petroleum, which is the world's largest oil company, in effect is no longer British, it's Anglo-American. It's owned by both Britain and British and American capital. It is based on the integration of British Petroleum with the American Oil Company and with Atlantic Richfield Corporation. But broadly speaking, the oil companies, Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, the large so-called defense contractors. In the United States, there are five major defense contractors, which are Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, General Dynamics, and Boeing. And to that you add British Aerospace Systems Corporation, which is the British, it's the heavyweight of the British military industrial complex. And again, we're talking about an Anglo-American alliance in the defense industry, namely British Aerospace, in fact, has the same rights as the Big Five as far as tendering for DOD, Department of Defense, contracts. We have the biotech conglomerates, very important because they own the intellectual property rights over genetic material. The whole discussion on genetically modified seeds is part of that understanding. They are integrated with the defense establishment because they produce biological and chemical weapons on contract to the Department of Defense. And finally, we have the media conglomerates, the media communications conglomerates, which are very important in framing our understanding of what actually is happening. And in this regard, the media have a tendency both to trivialize and distort the mechanisms underlying this financial crisis in the same way as they distort our understanding of what's happening in the Middle East. And they have a way of turning realities upside down. I think recent events in Gaza, corroborate that understanding that the victims are the aggressors and the aggressors are the victims. And in financial matters, they have ways of presenting the financial institutions the big banks as being, in fact, the victims, when in fact the victims is the broader public, the people whose savings have been confiscated through devious financial mechanisms, and where ultimately we are given, I mean, if we look at the various assessments of this crisis by the Conference Board, by the Ministry of Finance, by the think tanks, not to mention the economics profession, we have a very graphic understanding of what is actually happening, where somehow there's an economic movement, a downturn, and inevitably we're going to go up again. Okay, that's called the theory of the business cycle. It doesn't work that way. And there's nothing spontaneous in these movements. The movements on the stock market, on the money markets, are heavily manipulated, and they are manipulated largely as a result of what we understand as derivative trade. It's the capability that these financial institutions, as well as powerful individuals, or institutions which are not necessarily visible within the financial architecture, such as the hedge funds, to trigger upward and downward movements in a speculative onslaught, where they can speculate in an upward movement, and then they can speculate in the downward movement. They know when the turning point is going to occur, because they have the foresight, the knowledge, as well as the ability to trigger major shifts in direction. If you follow the currency markets in last few weeks, where you see the Canadian dollar going up and down, it's incidentally going down today. It's at 124 Canadian dollars to the US dollar, and last week it was 118 or 119. There's absolutely no logic, economic logic, to these short-term swings. They are speculative movements, and there's money to be made. As I said, we talk about short selling. These are operations which don't necessarily correspond to an actual transaction. You can make the stock market go up and down without necessarily buying or selling, and of course, disinformation concerning financial movements, which is then inserted into the circuit of financial and economic news, has the ability of triggering, of course, major collapses. Let us be under no illusion, there are powerful interests behind this process, and there are powerful interests behind the movement of these financial indicators. I recall that when General Motors, the fate of General Motors was being discussed over the last few months, the value of General Motors was collapsing, and the value of General Motors was collapsing because Deutsche Bank, which is part of the speculative cabal, had made a statement to the effect that we put a zero price on the shares of General Motors. Okay, so what happens then, coupled with the speculative backing to that assessment, the stock values of General Motors collapses. Whether the company is doing well or not is not the issue. The issue is that the collapse of a company, a troubled company, can occur, but you can also trigger the collapse of any other company, which happens to be the object of these speculative attacks. So we must understand that the types of instruments which have been concocted broadly in the last, I would say, certainly within the last 10 to 15 years, but more significantly since the enactment of the Financial Services Modernization Act in 1999, which in a sense deregulated the financial architecture. But this has created a new environment. I'll discuss a little bit the history of this, but again, we have to understand that it is the regulatory environment which creates, it's the policy environment which creates the crisis. The crisis is not the result of some spontaneous movement in market values. It's not the interplay of market values. It's a highly manipulated market. But nonetheless, if we're talking about the real economy, well, the real economy has been in crisis for quite a number of years. And this symbiotic relationship between the real economy and the financial economy is, of course, fundamental because the financial economy, in a sense, has the ability to trigger the bankruptcy of real economy companies, to trigger plant closures and so on through various mechanisms, one which I mentioned, the fact that they can push stocks up and down at will, the value of the stocks, but they can also paralyze the channels of credit, and that's what's happening now. They totally escape regulation. There's no... There used to be, in a foregone era, a framework where even energy prices were controlled, okay? You'd go to the gas station and the price was always the same, irrespective of variations. That... We had fixed exchange rates. If we go back further in history, to the 1970s, 60s, and 70s, but ultimately, what prevails is the laws of the jungle. The price of gasoline can go up to $1.60 and then down to 70 cents, and the financial analysts will lie through their teeth because they will tell you, well, it's due to in California, there's been a storm there, and now the demand for energy has gone up. Absolute nonsense. This is a speculative movement on the London, New York, and Chicago energy markets. The major actors are British Petroleum, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and a couple of French financial institutions, and they push the price up, they speculate in the energy market, and then they push it down. There is absolutely no bearing to cost of production because the cost of oil, of a barrel of oil in Saudi Arabia is $1.50, and the cost of a barrel of oil in Iran or Iraq is something like $5 a barrel, and then it might go up to $30 in the tar sands of Alberta. But again, we're very far from the structure of international oil prices during this boom period. And so we have to understand how this market is manipulated and what it does. It creates an enormous distance between the costs of producing a commodity and the actual price of the commodity. And that's not only an issue in the oil markets, it's practically an issue in every single commodity you purchase, okay? It's in the very nature of this economic system. And I can tell you that virtually everything you're wearing there costs approximately 10% of the price that you actually bought it for, okay? Because there's a markup of approximately 90 to 95% on all manufactured goods which are produced in China. And now the conference board has said that the GDP of Canada will go down by so much and the GDP of this, that, and other will go up. But bear in mind that these figures are totally meaningless because each time you import commodities from China, the GDP goes up. And the production doesn't occur here, it occurs over there. Okay? And it's a very simple, it's part of the ABC of national accounts that we teach at the university. It's based on the concept of value added. You buy at a dollar, you sell at $10, and there's an increase in GDP of $9. It's absolutely, and then they'll say, oh, our economy is booming. Okay? The US economy has been functioning on that basis, import-led development, for several decades now. So that we have, indeed, the real economy is absolutely shattered. okay? And it is sustained by cheap labor imports from countries where wages are at a dollar a day. It's predicated on compressing the purchasing power of working people both in the developed and the developing countries, which inevitably backlashes on production eventually, because by constraining society's capacity to consume, inevitably you lead the economy into a depression. But the whole logic of this is one of an economic system which has unlimited capacity to produce, given its technological base, its industrial capacity, and so on. But the very process of increasing production using abysmally cheap labor limits society's capacity to consume, so that we are in the framework of bankruptcy, layoffs, unemployment, which then in turn backlash again on the development of the development of the economic system. Now, I think we have to understand that this financial crisis of the last, it's the last few months, but it's been ongoing for quite some time now, at least a year and a half, that what we're dealing with is a massive transfer of wealth resulting from speculative trade, okay, from manipulation of stock markets, money markets, currency markets, namely the system, the large financial institutions appropriate wealth through the use of these speculative instruments, through highly leveraged operations via the hedge funds, and the transfer of wealth is essentially out of the pockets of people's lifelong savings. I think that is very well understood, that anybody, let's say in our age bracket, if they put their money in the stock market, they've lost at least 50-60% of what they had saved. Okay? And that goes also for the pension funds, which are dilapidated, because all those pension funds were invested in the stock market, and some of them were invested in the hedge funds and so on. So in some cases, people's savings have crumbled by 60-80%. Okay? So think of all the middle class doctors and lawyers and so on who are, it's the middle class people, lower income people are indebted. Well, their situation is even more dramatic, because they are heavily indebted to financial institutions via credit card debt, problems of foreclosure of house of homes and so on, people losing their jobs, and in fact, what we are seeing is a cumulative process. It's not immediately visible. I mean, the thing is, you read about it, because these closures are always in a particular region, in a particular city. So they will announce, they will say, today we had the General Motors has announced that it's closing its plants, etc. And then the following day it's another company. That's not a recent phenomenon. It's been going on for at least 10 years, this process of plant closure. But it has accelerated in the last year or so. And it is likely to accelerate even more because of the situation in the credit market and the power that these financial institutions now have over the real economy. They have accumulated vast amounts of private wealth, which they are now in a position to use. It's paper wealth. It's not necessarily ownership of productive capital. They own productive capital as well, but they have a lot of surplus money wealth. And what are they going to do when this whole recession bottoms out, they're going to go shopping. And they're going to pick up large corporations at rock bottom prices. We have already gone through the phase of destruction of small and medium-sized enterprises. But now we are in a new phase whereby large financial institutions, powerful individuals like Warren Buffett, are going after corporations. That's the real wealth of the economy. It's productive capital. It's the ownership of productive capital. And what do? They just take out their checkbook and write a $1 million check. And since they control money creation, they don't necessarily need to worry about where the money comes from. Essentially, we are in that kind of process. It's a financial, economic warfare against workers and workers, consumers, people who save, people who are retired, on the one hand, but it's also a conflict within the capitalist system. It's the confrontation of finance capital and real economy capital. It's also a struggle between competing financial conglomerates. We saw the fate of Citigroup. Citigroup used to be the largest financial institution. It's collapsed. It's going to be eaten up or taken over by some other company or some other financial institution. So that we're dealing with a very major transformation in the structure and architecture of the financial system. And what has been put forth are these bailouts. Now, I'll discuss them a little bit later on, but I would like to say at the outset is that the bailouts do not constitute a solution to the crisis. Quite the opposite, the bailouts are the cause of the crisis, because in effect what they do is to contribute to an even greater concentration and centralization of financial wealth in the hands of very few financial institutions. This is money which the government, the U.S. Treasury, but also our own Minister of Finance, they allocate this money to troubled financial institutions, but in effect these are the major financial institutions in the United States under the so-called Troubled Assets Relief Program. But in fact, that's a much broader project. And in effect, what happens is that this money is then used to consolidate these institutions. In fact, they use them to buy up other banks. Okay, so that you have a situation where the U.S. Treasury is handing money to the banks, and then the banks are using that money to enrich themselves, and that's another aspect. They are, because these banks are also the creditors of the government, so they say, okay, you give us. Well, the Troubled Assets Relief Program is $700 billion. Okay, so $700 billion. Where does it come from? It comes from the Treasury. Now, if I say, okay, here is would you like to take the $700 billion? Yeah, take the this is a $700 billion bailout to Bank America. Okay. Now, then Bank America says, well, hey, you guys, you've increased the public debt. And then they send in Moody and Standard and Poor and say that the debt rating of the federal government has been affected, etc. And said, well, yes, but what the hell? We are actually bailing you guys out. So what happens is, no, but this is exactly, you understand. We need to borrow the money. We need to borrow the money from the banks, not all of the money, because you have government bonds and treasury bills are sold on the market. Only a portion is held by the banks, okay? So the banks are partial. The creditors are the public at large, the Chinese, the Japs, and so on. And then the banks will take on maybe 20%, but they are the brokers of that public debt. Okay, they will sell the government bonds on the money markets. And so what is the government doing by handing a bailout money to the banks? They are in effect financing their own indebtedness. They are financing their own indebtedness. They are lending, they are giving money to the banks, and the banks are lending the money to the government so that the government can pay the bailout. That is what is happening. Okay? It's an absolutely circular process. And what does it do? I'll discuss it a little bit later on. It leads to an absolute spiraling of the public debt, something which nobody has actually dared to talk about. And the Canadian situation is also extremely critical. Now, let's give a little bit of historical background to this discussion. In the 1980s, following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rate, that was in 1971, we had the onslaught of what was called the Reagan-Thatcher era. In Canada, it was the Mulroney era. God bless him. But God bless the Liberals as well, because they continued that and made it even worse. But what happened was an initial process of restructuring of the financial architecture. The people who were in charge of this process, it just so happens the people who were in charge of that at the time, or one of the individuals, Mr. Volcker, is now on the advisory board of Osama. He's on the advisory board of Obama. Barack Obama, yes. So you must understand that there again there's a certain continuity from the crisis from the Reagan Thatcher era, where you had Paul Volcker, who was in charge of the Federal Reserve, leading to significant hikes in interest rates. And then also then we had a crisis in 1981. This was the first major stock market crisis of the post-war era. And this led up to a major financial meltdown in 1987. That period, incidentally, and it's very important to understand, was also characterized by the onslaught of what was called the debt crisis, affecting developing countries, and the Reagan-Thatcher era on the one hand, and the imposition of neoliberal reforms on developing countries, it was part of the same agenda. Perhaps it was double standards, because the types of policies applied in developing countries was really the strong medicine. But in effect, that strong medicine is now being applied very much in the all around the world. There's much more of an integrated agenda. But to get back to the discussion of these reforms, because as a result of the debt crisis, which occurred with the collapse of commodity prices in the early 80s, the rise in interest rates, many of the developing countries, as well as the oil-producing economies, such as Mexico, were unable to service their debt. And there was a problem of debt overhang in relation to Western creditors. And it is at that point that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, intervened and essentially came to the so-called rescue of the developing countries. Now, the logic was very similar to what we did just a moment ago, but there was slightly different logic. The countries are heavily indebted. They have billions of dollars of outstanding debt. Their debt servicing obligations have to be paid to commercial banks, as well as to the so-called Paris Club, which is the club of official creditors. And they said, well, we don't have the money. And the IMF then says, comes and says, well, there's no problem. We will lend you the money. And with the money that we lend you, you will pay us back. Okay? That is the basic fundamental principle of usury. Okay? Going back many centuries. It was the Catholic Church that tried to outlaw, actually, the usura during the Venetian period. But that's another matter. But the whole principle of usury is that you say, you lend the money. Now, what you do is you always establish certain conditions. And when the IMF goes into a developing country, they say, we're here to help you. Now, please take the money. Okay, but there are certain conditions or conditionalities attached to the acceptance of this, it's called a quick disbursing loan. It's a structural adjustment loan. It is there to support policy changes. Okay, so that the creditors dictate ultimately what you have to do. So there's $100 million, and you have an outstanding debt servicing obligation. I won't discuss the debt stock. Of $200 million. Okay? The conditions attached to this loan is that you close down your schools and your hospitals, implement drastic cuts in the budget deficit, privatize your telephone companies and infrastructure, etc., etc. In other words, that's the neoliberal packet of economic measures. And also, you must abide by the debt servicing obligations that you have to your international creditors, $200 million. So, thank you very much. He hands me back $100 million, and you still owe me $100 million. So that is essentially what this money has done. It's a fictitious transaction. It triggers the debt reimbursement process. We lend $100 million and we cash back $200 million, and in the process the debt goes up, okay? And that is the whole idea. And when the debt goes up, the creditors have more and more power and authority to dictate policy. And that mechanism is not only applied in developing countries, it characterizes essentially the whole context of the 1990s. And the transition, let's say, if we're talking about Canada, the transition from the conservative government into the liberals, and when you might recall when Paul Martin arrives at the helm of the Ministry of Finance, well, what does he do? He implements a major austerity measures, which are dictated by the creditors of the federal government and the provinces. Okay, and these austerity measures in turn lead to a disruption in the federal provincial transfers. That I'm talking about the 1995 or 4 budget. It was his historic budget where he said we're going to cut the transfers to the provinces and so on and so forth. And then ultimately, what happened was the onslaught of a major recession. Decline and demise of social programs. If we look at the situation in the province of Quebec in the mid-90s, we're dealing in the wake of the referendum, we're dealing with the policies of Lucien Bouchard. Well, the first thing that Lucien Bouchard did when he became prime minister was to go off to Wall Street for discussions behind closed doors. And he came back. I actually checked the archives of the National Assembly, and he didn't say what they talked about. He said we had very good discussions. Okay? But it was very clear that the whole process of zero deficit, deficit zero, was imposed by Wall Street, and it's very similar to the IMF agenda. It Moody's and Standard and Poor's are the entities which act in the process of surveillance rather than the IMF. So they will say, well, the Quebec debt is B plus plus, minus whatever, C plus. It's the same way as we grade our students at the university, okay? And then when they do really good on their term papers, we give them an A plus. But so that in essence, what these debt rating agencies do is to grade government performance. They're not really interested in the debt per se. They are interested in whether the policymakers obey orders and whether they accept to implement the types of policies which serve their interests, namely privatization, the curtailment of public expenditure on health and education, the eventual privatization of the healthcare sector, which is part of their agenda, the financial reforms, which are then implemented in the late 90s, and so on. So, again, what occurred in the 1990s in Canada, in the United States, is in essence a replicate of these IMF reforms in a very different environment. But again, it's the sovereignty of the creditors over policy. It's the fact that financial institutions call the shots. They have tremendous power. In the United States, they buy up politicians. It's pretty obvious that all these people, all these politicians are figureheads, including, Obama. Osama's also a figurehead, but that's another matter. And they dictate. Now, important events in the 90s, and that's why I say this depression really starts in the 90s. It starts in the 80s, in essence. In the 90s, it's the post-Cold War measures which are applied, namely strong economic medicine in the former Soviet Union, in the Balkans, in India, in the 1991 new economic policy. Very devastating reforms. Usually under the stewardship of the IMF and the World Bank. In the late 90s, 97, you have the Asian crisis. You also have a major financial collapse in the fall of 97. But the Asian crisis is somewhat different from previous financial interventions, because it was triggered by speculative trade in the currency markets, by short selling of currencies, with a view to triggering the collapse of the Korean won, the Thai baht, and the Indonesian rupiah. It was a process, it was a deliberate process using short selling, which is a derivative mechanism. It doesn't require actual transactions in the currency market, because short selling is selling something you don't possess, okay? So I take out a whole bunch of Thai bahts. I don't do that. That's not. If I take out the Thai bahts, I sell them, that's an actual transaction. No. What they do is they say, we are selling Thai bahts by the billions. Okay? We don't have them. It doesn't matter. We're selling Thai bahts by the billions. Then the Thai baht collapses. And then when it collapses, and who buys a Thai baht? The only one institution buys a Thai baht. It's the Thai Central Bank. Okay? And they exchange it for US dollars. When the contract comes to fruition, because it's a 3-month or 6-month contract, well, the Thai baht has collapsed, and what do the people who have undertaken the short selling? They simply go into the spot market, buy the Thai baht, and then the contract is completed, and in the process they make a 50% profit on the collapse of a national currency, and that is what occurred. Okay. And it was a deliberate process. It was preceded by mechanisms which which obliged the country to deregulate the foreign exchange market. We had the same thing in Brazil the following year, 98. It was 99 in Brazil, when the January 99, when the it was Russia 98, and then in the following year it was Brazil, and it was done exactly in the same way. And in Brazil, what they did is the IMF said, we're going to give you a $42 billion loan to support your currency. And that's a fabulous thing to do, because what you do is you give them $42 billion, and then you impose a deregulated exchange market, so that in effect what you are doing is you're financing capital flight. Okay? It means that the country is obliged to exchange its money, to allow speculators to move back into dollars and take their money out, and it's financed by the $42 billion from the IMF. So that all these measures ultimately were concocted to put the countries into a very fragile situation. It was a manipulated process. Alan Greenspan made a very famous speech in October of 97. I remember that speech, and probably many people in this room remember. He said, the American economy is very healthy, but we must beware of the Asian flu. Well, it wasn't exactly that, I'm paraphrasing, but he said that he introduced the process of infection resulting from economies which were unstable and badly managed and so on. Okay, now it's interesting how disinformation evolves, because back in July of 97, everybody was saying how resilient, how efficient these Asian economies are, the Asian miracle. There was even a report of the World Bank that was called the Asian miracle, and everybody should emulate these Asian economies. And then in September, October, I believe, Alan Greenspan says, oh no, the Asian flu is really the menace, and we should make sure that these Asian countries, that their economies are so infected that they don't infect us, because we are healthy. And now, and then, from one day to the next, all the financial analysts were talking about how economic infection spreads. You know, the virus spreads from one country to another. And if you look at, I'm not kidding, many of my colleagues then started submitting articles to learned journals on the process of economic infection and building mathematical models. And it was all fabricated by Alan Greenspan, and then the whole propaganda apparatus of news, financial news, comes into play. The fact of the matter is, if you look at what happened in Korea in December 97, which is absolute scandal, where the U.S. Embassy demands the firing of the finance minister because they want to implement certain protective measures in their foreign currency market. Well, they had 35,000 troops in Korea. They said, no, you fire the finance minister. And then hire this other guy who was a former IMF World Bank official. And so they rush him off to Washington, and then they come back with an agreement. And what happens is the whole money market collapses. And then they impose, because this was their bailout of the Korean central bank, they impose the actual takeover of the Korean economy. And they say, this is fabulous, because look, the Koreans are so fabulous, and they've got these high-tech companies and hard workers and engineers and scientists, and we take it over. In fact, I tell you, it was taken over at a negative price. The Korean economy was taken over and financed by government grants on loan from the IMF. Okay, so they used money, they financed the foreign investors. So the foreign investors can come in, take over the most profitable assets for a few $100 million, and in return, they receive subsidies for several $1 billion to cover the non-performing loans, etc. It was all manipulated, very carefully manipulated. I discussed that in one of the chapters of Globalization of Poverty, but the intrigues behind this and how these major financial institutions managed to ransack one of the most advanced, technologically advanced economies in the world and buy out its capital and productive base, okay, it boggles the mind. But it happened, okay? And I mention this because that is, in a sense, the model which is being envisaged for the North American economy, namely that the financial institutions want to buy out the real economy with all its capabilities, because that the real economy is the real economy. These people have paper wealth, which is acquired. It's not acquired through capital accumulation, the so-called, you know, the definitions you might find in Marx or the classical economists, where they say capitalism is the ownership of the means of production and we manage our factories and exploit workers. They don't do that. They don't do that. They manipulate financial markets, they make speculative gains, and then they use those speculative gains to buy out real companies. Okay? That is what is happening today. Now, this leads us up to, 1998, the ruble collapses. It's the same process short selling of currencies, speculative movement on the stock markets. And 99, it's Brazil. And in 99, November 99, marks a very major turning point in the financial architecture through the adoption of what is called the Financial Services Modernization Act. The Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999, which was a Republican initiative. It was the Graham Leach. Wait a minute. There's another guy involved. Smiley. It's the Graham Leach Bliley. Yeah. Graham Leach Bliley. But it was essentially Graham, Phil Graham, senator, Republican senator, who pushed it through. But it was pushed through in the last year of the Clinton administration, and one man who played a very key role in this piece of legislation was Larry Summers. Okay, now Larry Summers was vice president of the World Bank at one. No, he was chief economist. Yes, but that's. That gives him the status of vice president. He's chief economist at the World Bank, and he is appointed Secretary of the Treasury. He happens to be today the advisor, the White House economic advisor to Barack Obama. And consequently, those who have been appointed to advise or to set the architecture, the financial architecture under the Obama administration are the architects of this Financial Services Modernization Act, which essentially creates the environment which has triggered this crisis. Okay? And I'll say a few words about this Financial Services Modernization Act, but I want you to know that the people behind this piece of legislation are the people who are now in charge. So the people who are the cause of the crisis are now being brought back as a solution to the crisis. Larry Summers was Secretary of the Treasury at the time, and the Financial Services Modernization Act repeals a major piece of legislation going back to the 1930s, which was under the Roosevelt administration, which is called the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933.